This is a war between the government and the Tamil people.
I'm not a fucking terrorist. You are the terrorist.
People are crying out for justice in this country.
If you've got to be militant to achieve your aims and your aspirations, so be it.
There's a real hypocrisy from the big corporations.
The people from below will push for real change.
This Australia is going to be shocked, and then the public will say, what the hell's going on?
Good morning, and welcome to another edition of the Indie Media Show. Big thank you, first of all, to Jeff for another wonderful edition of On The Record. And, of course, you can listen to On The Record every weekday from 9 a.m. My name's Alex Wisson. Very chuffed to be in the studio. It's been a while, so very glad to be here. And I'm joined by my illustrious co-host, Zoe. How are we this morning, Zoe?
Hello, Alex. I am wonderful. Great to be sitting opposite you this morning.
Absolutely. It is an immense privilege for you.
It's refreshing.
It's refreshing. No, seriously, it's good to be in the studio. Hopefully I can start doing it more often from next year onwards. Plenty to come up, plenty to get on with, rather, on the show. We're going to be having an interview with Tyler Ray, who's a nurse at Charlie Gardner Hospital, and he's been very active in the Australian Nursing Federation. He was actually part of an emergency press conference that was held with Janet Rea. He's been in the trenches, so to speak, of this ongoing campaign for better wages conditions for Western Australian nurses, a campaign which, as you know, if you've been following it, has taken all sorts of twists and turns, from a strike that was to be held at Fiona Stanley Hospital that was aborted at the 11th hour by Chief Executive of the ANF, Mark Olson. There was then a membership backlash to that cancelling of the strike. And there was threats by the Industrial Relations Commission to deregister the union. McGowan has said that the strike action that subsequently went ahead was illegal. All kinds of moving parts to this dispute. Pretty dramatic stuff, and very important in terms of the broader industrial relations picture in this state at the moment, regardless of which side of the fence you are on. And I'd like to think most of our listeners are on the side of the nurses, then. But regardless of which position you might adopt, certainly I would argue the outcome of this dispute will have pretty significant ramifications for workers across Western Australia in terms of that industrial relations landscape and the precedent it might set for the future. So looking forward to having a chat with Tyler a little later on. And also on the back of various sort of tangential approaches to the topic of Australian international affairs, Australian military and foreign policy. We've mentioned, for instance, on a number of occasions, the war in Ukraine. And as I mentioned, kind of tangentially, Australia's involvement in that. We thought it would be a good time to have a bit more of a historical focus with this interview, and that's something we're mindful of the show, trying to bring things that are of historical and educational value to our listeners, as well as things that are contemporaneous to the current news cycle. And it's in that spirit that we're going to be speaking a little later on to Professor Clinton Fernandez. Clinton is Professor of International and Political Studies at the University of New South Wales in Canberra, part of the Australian Defence Force Academy, as well as a former intelligence officer for the Australian Army. And he's the author of numerous books, including his latest, published by Melbourne University Press, Sub-Imperial Power, Australia in the International Arena. So looking forward to catching up with Professor Fernandez a little later on as well. And Zoe, what else is going on?
I'm just going to be hitting you with an awful lot of news a little later in the show. And follow, like, primarily of that, I will be focusing on the proposed Waratah coal project, which was... is not going ahead, thankfully. So I have an interview following that next week, but I will let you know about that within the news.
I was going to say, as a joke, like, hopefully it's positive news, but lo and behold, it actually is positive news. Unbelievable.
Yeah, genuinely is positive news.
We didn't even fix this in advance. It just so happened to be positive news. No, that is an excellent development. So all that and more coming up here on the Indie Media Show on RTRFM 92.1, The Sound Alternative.
Australia is going to be shocked, and then the public will say, what the hell's going on?
As I said at the top of the show, it's been quite a long and winding and dramatic tale, the tale of the Australian Nurses Federation and nurses in their efforts to secure better wages and conditions, which we might add is just one of many bubbling disputes across the Western Australian economy at the moment. Public sector workers, prison officers, police officers, health support workers and others have been endeavouring to secure better wages in particular, but also a improvement in their conditions, but better wages because of the economic context, highest rate of inflation in 40 years, CPI running at around 7.3% in the last quarter, and many unions are hoping to get wage deals commensurate with or in line with that consumer price index inflation increase. The current magical number, if you like, that's sitting on the table for nurses is 5%. It seems McGowan might be forced to make that compromise offer, although the current offer sits at around 3% a year, and the nurses had initially asked for 10%. So, don't want to predict the future, but it may, in the final analysis, lead to a settlement of 5%. We'll have to wait and see. But to discuss some of the whys and wherefores of the campaign to date, I had the opportunity on the weekend to speak to Tyler Ray. Tyler is an enrolled nurse at Sir Charlie Gardner Hospital and very much an active member of the Australian Nurses Federation. And I began by asking Tyler about his own experience of the strike that did, in fact, in the end take place on Friday the 25th of November, the first strike by Western Australians, by Western Australian nurses since 1998, one held remarkably in defiance of an Industrial Relations Commission order. And I asked Tyler for his own experience as well as his general sense of the will of nurses on that day to fight.
The strike was fantastic. The atmosphere on the day was absolutely electric, standing out with thousands of my colleagues at Parliament House, and also knowing that there were thousands of, well, hundreds of colleagues in actions across the state, as well as thousands at work supporting our strike, was really just a great day to feel part of a great big healthcare system that provides important care to patients and our community. It also felt really good to be standing up for ourselves and for our patients when it came to what we consider to be a really lousy offer from the government.
And standing up in circumstances that can't have been easy, because on the day of the strike, the Health Minister, Amber Jade Sanderson, herself a former union official, it should be added, an Assistant Secretary of United Voice, called the ANF State Secretary Janet Rhea at 6 o'clock that morning, which, in my opinion, that in itself is intimidatory, called Janet Rhea at 6 o'clock in the morning, urging her to call off the strike. And Rhea, to her credit, didn't budge, went ahead with the strike, ignored a summons to appear before the IRC later that morning, and instead addressed a rally of thousands of nurses and supporters outside Parliament House. I mean, fabulous stuff, really, and a great exercise of leadership by Secretary Rhea, I must say. How important was that defiance by Rhea? And, of course, it's not about her, you know, as an individual secretary. It's even more importantly, there's the membership and their defiance. So, you know, with that aspect of it, Tyler, there's a lot of pressure under the union to cave, really, and magnificent that they went out on strike and held this rally regardless.
Yeah, well, I think that's right about the defiance. Rhea's defiance was, of course, important because as much as I would like, and there is a sentiment amongst some nurses to call for rallies or strikes or community support actions in support of the nurses' campaign, we're not organized enough on a sort of granular level to call that sort of thing. And so it needs to come from the ANF leadership. But it's the defiance was essential because it was really the members who got us there on the day. You know, it was the members who rejected the vote. It was the members who, by rejecting the vote and agreeing with Rhea's proposal that if we say no to the government's fourth offer, that we will have a one-day statewide action. That was nurses. That was the membership of the ANF who did that. And so, really, I think Rhea, to her credit, was taking the lead of the members who are really fed up with what the government is offering and the sort of, well, what is essentially a pay cut to all of us. So the defiance was important, but more important to me, I think, was the show of solidarity with the ANF's leadership for what the members wanted.
Now, speaking of which, and I hadn't provided this question to you advance in written form for the benefit of the listenership, and I do apologize, I don't mean to blindside you by this, Tyler, and every reason, I guess, to keep internal union criticisms internal and not either in public. So feel free, I guess, to bat away this question. But there has been some ructions, some divisions within the union. The chief executive of the union, Mark Olson, who was the secretary for more than 20 years, he actually did accept the government offer, which we'll get into the details of that later, without really consulting the membership. There had been a strike plan at Fiona Stanley Hospital last month. Olson called that off and said, look, we're actually accepting an offer from the government. Long story short, he was booed by a section of the membership, and then we eventually got to a point where, there was a strike in defiance of that offer. So, you know, feel free to choose to, I guess, comment on that whether you want to or not, Tyler, in terms of those divisions within the union. I guess what it says about the spirit to fight, you know, the will to fight of the membership.
Well, I think you said it exactly. You've already answered the question, right? The division, most importantly, has been from the leadership under Olson to the members' wishes about the pay deal. They were booed immediately. I think it was probably an hour or so after walking out of the WAIRC where they agreed to that deal. The news had just broken. People were not happy with it. Everyone can tell that everyone knows the deal is a pay cut. As much as the government likes to say they just want to put money in our pockets, it's less money than we get at the end of the year. With inflation, then we had voted in a mass meeting weeks prior for 10%, and I think also to the discredit of the leadership, that claim for 10% was dismissed out of hand by the union, which is no way to go to a negotiating table. But really, in terms of the momentum of the membership for rejecting the deal and pushing for more, I think that has to be really the biggest focus. That's really where things are coming from, not so much the internal divisions amongst one layer or another of the union. It's about the membership who are pushing for more, because honestly, we deserve more. And I think the community believes that and knows that as well, that we work hard and we don't deserve a pay cut.
There has been a sense that I don't know the figures off the top of my head, don't have them in front of me, but a sense of certainly wide community support, Tyler. Getting to the heart of the dispute itself, and you've already mentioned that nurses actually voted for a 10% pay rise. That was back on the 12th of October. There's also been some movement by the government on the question of better nurse-to-patient ratios. McGowan certainly has made a big song and dance about conceding to that demand. I don't know what your comments are on that. But in terms of the pay offer, McGowan has come back with $60 a week or 3% per annum, whichever is greater, as well as a one-off so-called cost of living payment of $3,000. Meanwhile, Rhea has suggested that 5% might be enough from her point of view. So lots of moving parts to this, Tyler, but what do you think nurses are prepared to accept in a final settlement? Is 5% is 5% enough, or should nurses keep pushing for that 10%?
I have argued in my speech at the rally, as well as with my colleagues, that 10% is actually a fair number. That inflation in WA for this year is looking to fall somewhere between 7% and 8%. We have already received wage cuts in real terms from 2017, when the McGowan government came into power and we made an agreement for $1,000 increases over each year. So we're really only asking for 2% of a real wage rise at 10%, which is, after 5 years of wage cuts, is more than enough. Is more than fair, I think. If I'm being honest, I think nurses would accept 5%, though I wouldn't be happy with it personally. And about the ratio things, I think that the government tries to put it like the ratios are separate from the pay issue. But as was said in the rally, from many speeches at the front, not just from Raya, but also nurses who work on the floor, and including myself, we won't be able to attract staff without a competitive salary. And so you can't have ratios on the floor without having enough staff on the floor. And so whatever timeline you come up with won't be enough unless you can pay the nurses enough to bring them over.
Now, it can't be emphasised enough, Tyler, just how much pressure nurses are under in this campaign. The government took out a full-page ad in the West Australian denouncing the actions of the nurses' union. McGowan has called the strike illegal. The West Australian had an editorial railing against the nurses. Just pressure coming from all kinds of directions, the right-wing press, the government and so on. And also from the Industrial Relations Commission, where in an extraordinary move, days after the strike, the senior commissioner, Rachel Cosentino, wrote to Secretary Rhea threatening the ANF with the suspension of their registration as a union. After a meeting attended by Rhea with the IRC on Thursday, that threat has now been revoked, at least for now. Big question, Tyler, but what do you think will happen next? Rhea said on Thursday that, quote, the nurses are in for a long campaign, but she has, at least for now, also ruled out further industrial action. So what are the next steps? What can we expect to see unfold, you know, next in this campaign?
I really can't say. We need to get more information from the union leadership. Things have gone quite quiet from the leaders about our next steps. Rhea, I think, understandably said there's no plans for further strikes at the moment, but I don't think she said there won't be any. She didn't say there won't be any.
She was quite pointed in her words that no plans for now is really the gist of what she said. Mm.
Exactly. And I think really we will have to have more. There will have to be disruption to the health service, as is already occurring because of our access block, our ramping, things that have been well known and well documented and has been a big sticking point for this government for years. That is already occurring, but what we'll need to continue is, forced disruption to the health service from the point of view of the nurses, as well as, I think, building a bit of more of a sort of community campaign. So there don't have to be strikes, but there could be rallies. I think rallies with support of the community would be something that we should look to doing. It can help put pressure on the McGowan government, who really feels very little pressure in sense of outside political pressure. The fact that the Liberals are, you know, a minority party there, that is something that I think McGowan will need to feel pressure from community and threats to his longevity, I guess.
Just on that final point, Tyler, it does seem that, perhaps I'm being overly optimistic, that this is the first sign of a chink in the armour, if you like, of McGowan, who has been thus far an indomitable force in Western Australian politics. But just extrapolating from that thought, I mean, what are the wider repercussions here, or what is the wider significance of this dispute, do you think, Tyler? Because it's certainly being watched by all players, so to speak, in industrial relations in the state. That's why we've got you on the show. It's inspiring. It's a very important dispute, one being followed by public sector and private sector workers in relation to their own struggles for better pay and conditions. So what are the broader lessons here, do you think, about how to fight bosses, whether it is in the private or public sector, and how to win campaigns? And hopefully this will be a win for the nurses in the final analysis.
Yeah, hopefully. I think the lessons are unfolding, right? But one thing that we can definitely say, and I've been telling all my colleagues this, is we wouldn't be here if it wasn't for the pressure that members have put, not only on the government, but also because the government has modified to a small degree the wage claim. They have agreed to the ratios. That is something that has been asked by nurses for decades. They did make small changes to the wage agreement, but the opposition to the deal, I think, pressuring Rhea to come out in support of the nurses who disliked the last deal on offer and to say no, who said no, those were all things that were done because members feel fed up. Members feel that we are entitled to more. I mean, billionaires in the last 2 years across Australia have doubled their wealth, while we who work for a daily, for our daily wages are being offered wage cuts. I think that's sort of something really wrong, and that what it's going to take is sustained organization, as well as like a commitment from members to fight against these lousy deals, because we are currently losing in the sense that we've been getting wage cuts for quite a while. Our conditions have declined. And what it's going to take is a real sustained pushback, as well as broadening out, I think, not just local or sort of workplace issues, but also the community. And health is one of those areas where, you know, the community sees how much we work. People who deal in the healthcare system can see how stretched we are. And I think there's an appetite there for improvement because it affects everyone at some point.
Tyler Ray there, a nurse and rank-and-file Australian Nursing Federation activist at Charles Gairdner Hospital, speaking to me yesterday about the ongoing campaign for better wages and conditions. And, yeah, watch this space. As Secretary Janet Rea said, quote, they're in for a long campaign. It's going to head into the new year. Got one of those disputes that's probably going to end up being a war of attrition, and it may be that whichever side is exhausted first will come to the table with a compromise offer. We'll have to wait and see.
You're listening to the Indie Media Podcast, first broadcast on RTRFM 92.1.
You're back with the Indie Media Show here on RTRFM 92.1, the Sound Alternative. It's just gone 11:30, and it's time now for some news.
A Hong Kong man who was shot by police at close range during the 2019 democracy protests has been jailed for 6 years on charges including obstructing a police officer and attempted robbery of the officer's gun. Chow Pak Kwan, now 23, lost his right kidney and suffered injuries to his liver and spine after being shot at a road intersection during between protesters and police. Footage of the incident on November 11, 2019 showed an armed police officer grappling with another protester on the street and Chow then appearing at the crossing. Shortly afterwards, the officer who was assigned the traffic division fires at the black-clad Chow, who was unarmed. Another, a man, appears to try and grab the officer's gun from the police officer after he then fires two more shots at Chow. The entire incident was live-streamed on Facebook. On Wednesday, Judge Adriana C. sentenced Chow to 6 years in jail for charges that included attempt to escape from custody. The judge said Chow's attempt to grab the officer's gun would have inflamed the crowd's emotions and was a factor that contributed to his lengthy sentence. Chow's defense lawyers argued that he was not trying to grab the gun, but push it away in attempt to defend himself. A top Ukrainian presidential aide criticized Twitter owner Elon Musk for the billionaire's magical simple solution, citing ideas put forward by Musk on Russia's invasion of Ukraine on Twitter's content moderation. Mykhailo Podolyak listed exchanging foreign territories for illusionary peace and the opening of all private accounts because freedom speech had to be total as examples of such suggestions. Elon Musk also prefers so-called magical simple solutions on Twitter, an apparent reference to the self-described free speech advocate to reform Twitter, as well as the tweet which he called for Ukraine to give up the Russian-occupied Crimean Peninsula in exchange for peace. Just before the weekend, a proud and beautiful Noongar mother expecting her second child was hit by a concrete block in a senseless alleged attack in the south of Perth that has died in hospital along with her unborn child. Diane Miller had been in critical condition in an intensive care ward in Royal Perth Hospital after suffering a heart attack when the block was allegedly thrown through the car window in the Waterford Shopping Centre in Karawara on Tuesday night. The 30-year-old Noongar woman passed away after the decision to turn her life support off was made by family. The 17-year-old boy, who allegedly threw the concrete block, faced Perth's Children's Court on Wednesday and being charged with grievous bodily harm and a breach of bail. He was remained in custody is due to return to court on the 9th of December. Puerto Rico could get $3 billion for rooftop solar energy and battery storage if Congress approves Biden administration's request made earlier this week to help. The archipelago has been repeatedly hit by blackouts after a series of devastating hurricanes that crippled the electricity grid. In 2019, Hurricane Irma, which narrowly missed the main island but caused widespread blackouts, was then followed by another, Maria, which killed over 4,000 people. Maria's damage to Puerto Rico's grid was so great that it took 11 months for the power to be fully restored to the main island. Both Puerto Rican activists and United States officials believe that investing in solar systems will help the residents keep their power during more and certain destructive storms in the Caribbean. Puerto Rico's energy grid has been criticized for years for its unreliability under normal circumstances, even without the storm damage of power lines and generators. Tuvalu defining attribute on the global stage as the precarious nature of its existence. In less than 100 years, it will disappear. But an effort to preserve Tuvalu's maritime boundaries, culture and sovereignty in the face of stochastic events, the rising sea level and rising sea levels, Tuvalu's Prime Minister, Kyusa Natio, announced he is leading Tuvalu to an online existence. In a speech to leaders at COP27, he described the climactic threats facing the country. He would help bring it into the metaverse. This is our digital nation, to provide an online presence that will replace our physical being. Bruce Lehman will not face a second trial after the prosecution dropped its rape case against him due to unacceptable risk to Brittany Higgins' life. ACT Director of Public Prosecution Shane Drummond confirmed that the road of prosecution on Friday raising concerns about the unprecedented personal attack. Mr. Lehman, who pled not guilty to a single charge of sexual intercourse without consent, was scheduled for a retrial in the Supreme Court of February next year. It was alleged that the offence took place inside Linda Reynolds' ministerial office in Parliament House after a night out of drinking with colleagues in March. Sadly, Ms. Higgins is now currently undergoing mental health treatment in a Queensland-based hospital after the unrelenting pressure over the last few years. And lastly, last week, the court ruled that Clive Palmer's proposed Waratah coal project would unjustifiably infringe upon human rights in a landmark climate change case. The case marked the first time an Australian court has heard evidence-based country against coal mined and according to First Nations protocols. President of the Queensland Land Court, Fleur Kingham, recommended on Friday that the proposal for a mining lease, an environmental project to dig Queensland's largest coal mine in the Galilee Basin, should be rejected by the state government. Kingham said that the approval would be refused on environmental, climate and human rights grounds, telling the court that the mine would unjustifiably limit the right to life, cultural rights of First Nations people, the rights to children, rights to property, privacy, home, and to enjoy their human rights equally. The historic case was brought by a group of young people, Youth Verdict, which was led by First Nations members. They argued the coal mine would contribute to climate change and limit their cultural rights as First Nations people. Marawa Johnson, Youth Verdict's First Nation lead and co-director, said the group is overjoyed by the result. Later in the week, I will be speaking to Marawa about the decision, so be sure to be listening to Indie Media next week for that story.
Excellent. We kept our promise to have some positive news there. That was a very uplifting final item. Thanks very much for that, Zoe. Moving on to our next interview, and I want to read you an excerpt from the latest book by our next guest, Professor Clinton Fernandez, who is a Professor of International Political Studies at the University of New South Wales in Canberra, part of the Australian Defence Force Academy. And I might add, he's a former intelligence officer for the Australian Army, so it might surprise you what his central thesis is in his latest volume, which is entitled Sub-Imperial Power, Australia in the International Arena, now available online at all good bookstores, published by Melbourne University Press. And in the introduction to that book, he writes, and I quote, This book examines the claim that Australia is a middle power trying to uphold a rules-based international order. Rejecting these euphemisms, it shows that Australia is a sub-imperial power upholding a US-led imperial order, end quote. A very bold and contentious claim by very much a mainstream academic, and intrigued by his thoughts and having followed his work for some time, thought I'd take the opportunity to interview Professor Clinton Fernandez with something more of a historical and educational bent to this interview, but also it's very much germane to a lot of developments we see in the news on the foreign policy front as well. And I began my discussion with Professor Fernandez by addressing what is seen as a key historical moment in the relationship between Australia and the United States. In a radio address in December 1941, Australian Prime Minister John Curtin told the nation, and I quote, "Without any inhibitions of any kind, I make it quite clear that Australia looks to America free of any pangs as to our traditional links or kinship with the United Kingdom." 2 months later, the British garrison at Singapore fell to the Japanese. It was one of the most humiliating defeats in British military history, and in the eyes of many, symbolised the shift from British to American global supremacy. It also marked the beginning of a long period, if it hadn't begun earlier, of Australia standing in lockstep with American foreign policy around the world. Professor Clinton Fernandez, was John Curtin justified at the time, amid the exigencies of World War and a possible Japanese invasion of Australia, in throwing the nation's lot in with the American Empire?
Prime Minister Curtin's decision was extremely wise and, in fact, the most rational thing that any Prime Minister could have done. Yes. They did try to go further, of course. I mean, Curtin was not rejecting Britain so much as understanding that there is a new rising power on the other side of the Pacific Ocean, and basically for Australia's World War II, it would be a Pacific war. It made perfect sense then to get as close to the United States as possible in order to try to even influence war strategy. Now, there were limits to what could be achieved. You know, a few months after that statement, the commander-in-chief of U.S. forces in the Pacific, Douglas MacArthur, arrived in Australia, and Curtin's war cabinet met with him. And Curtin was actually trying to get even closer to the United States and wanted to have greater involvement, but MacArthur rebuffed him. That part is not mentioned by historians. You know, MacArthur said, and this is pretty much a verbatim quote, that we have no interest in Australia. Australia is basically a platform from which we can hit the Japanese. It is, you know, we have no particular interest in what happens in Australia. Even if our people are motivated by fond feelings towards Australians, our concern is really how to use Australia as a base to hit the Japanese. And so, yes, Curtin made an overture. In my view, it was very wise and rational, but also any further overtures were rebuffed.
So justified foreign policy shift at the time, but jumping forward now to 1951, Professor Fernandez, that's the year when the Menzies government signed up to ANZUS, the Australian-New Zealand-United States Security Treaty, a Cold War alliance, the NATO of the South Pacific, if you like, which formally cemented what you would argue is Australia's sub-imperial role in the American-led international order. What do you say to the commonly held view, with which older listeners in particular would be familiar, that Australia needed a big brother at the time, that the threat of the so-called Russian bear and its allies in the Asian region was so great that Canberra had no choice but to, as it were, cower under the shade of America's nuclear umbrella?
I'd say that the foreign minister in question, Percy Spender, negotiated the ANZUS Treaty with the United States and New Zealand. And yes, it was signed in 1951. And it's basically been the bedrock of Australian strategic thinking since then. And so Spender, although he wasn't in office for very long, he's had the most long-lasting legacy as a foreign minister, judged simply by the ANZUS Treaty. But once again, it wasn't very much. Okay, he was trying to do basically the same thing that Curtin was trying to do, and all he could get was a Pacific Pact that was not the NATO of the Southwest Pacific or of anywhere else. NATO commits the various members of NATO to act in the common interest, and an attack on one is an attack on all, and they will act, you know, with weapons to fight back. ANZUS provides no such guarantee. It is a talk shop and that too, not a very effective one. In fact, it wasn't until the United States really needed Australia and its real estate, you know, to establish the facilities at Pine Gap and Narunga and the Northwest Cape, that the United States began to take a serious interest in Australia. We were regarded as a nice piece of real estate. So ANZUS did not actually constitute anything like NATO.
Now, we're going to jump around with some of the history here, Professor Fernandez. We're limited in terms of our time, but so we'll have to take a broad brushstrokes approach to all the questions we're analysing. But if we do take that broad brushstrokes approach to post-World War II history, it's abundantly clear that Australia did indeed, as Curtin declared in 1941, look to America for its lead. You've already mentioned the Pine Gap intelligence space, which remains in Australia to this day. From the Korean War to Vietnam to the First Gold War of 1991, Somalia, the wars in Afghanistan, Iraq, all the way through to support for American interventions in Libya, Syria and Ukraine, Australia has maintained what some would argue was a craven relationship, a relationship of subordination to the United States. Is that an accurate characterisation of the relationship, or has it instead been a relationship that has first and foremost benefited Australian elites, or benefited, if you like, the Australian ruling class?
Look, craven is something that is said by opponents of such an alliance, and it's a value judgment. I don't want to enter into that. But the subordination aspect of your question is correct. I mean, that's just a neutral statement. You know, it is the Australian Defence Force's mission to be interoperable with the United States, or is it to defend Australia? And the answer to that is, it is to be interoperable with the United States. The Royal Australian Air Force, for example, has been optimized to effectively be a wing of the United States Air Force. We are acquiring nuclear-powered submarines, not to defend Australia, but to be interoperable with the United States in the South China Sea and the Taiwan Strait. That subordination is a neutral statement. Either a country subordinates its defense policy to operate with a greater power, or it doesn't. And if it does, it subordinates. But I wouldn't say craven is sort of, it carries a certain loaded sentiment, which I don't subscribe to. I think it's a rational decision in which our government and our defense planners and foreign affairs planners want to uphold what they call a rules-based international order. Now, the euphemism is rules-based international order. What it actually is an imperial order in which the United States sits at the apex of a hierarchically structured imperial system, and there are a number of other countries and its allies and so on that are below it. And they basically have to subordinate themselves in order to uphold that order.
There is so much more we could discuss, Professor Fernandez. We may well have to get you on another time to explore these matters in greater depth, but briefly turning to what I certainly regard as a crystal clear case study in the brutal realities of Australian foreign policy, and that's the question of Timor-Leste. Now, we simply don't have time to go through the whole history, but it's in the official documentary record. It's been proven with publicly available evidence that Australian governments, including the Whitlam government, actually, in the lead-up to the invasion, provided tacit and sometimes overt logistical, military, political and economic support for the Indonesian invasion and genocide in Timor-Leste. A third of the population, some 200,000 people, were killed by the Indonesians, many tortured to death and massacred. Why did Australia act so shamefully throughout this whole period? And why, for instance, did Prime Ministers Paul Keating and John Howard back the Indonesian dictator Suharto, the man principally responsible for these crimes, right up until his final days in power?
Well, the invasion 75 was green-lighted by the Whitlam government and defended diplomatically by him and his successors at the United Nations and elsewhere. There is no question about that. But the reason why the invasion occurred has to be understood. It is because the Timorese were trying to mobilize their own population assert development and economic advancement on their own terms. That was anathema to Indonesia, because the Indonesian dictatorship wanted to suppress political activity. It didn't want any village-level mobilizations. And the Indonesians feared that if a successful example of development occurred in Timor, in the middle of the Indonesian archipelago, it would be a challenge to the Indonesian dictatorship's rule. And the head of the Indonesian section at DFAT understood that and said so. Now, as for the rest of it, it's basically once you're in, you're in, and you kind of perpetuate the foreign policy decisions of your predecessor. Foreign policy doesn't occur in a long-term perspective. It occurs in a short-term perspective by whoever happens to be in government. And then any problems that arise are kicked down the road for the next government to solve. And so Whitlam's decision was continued by Fraser, by Hawke, by Keating, and ultimately by John Howard, who was really forced by a tidal wave of public opinion to reverse that policy after Suharto resigned and assist the Timorese to achieve independence. And then, of course, steal their oil.
Well, indeed, and a very mixed picture in terms of the later history of really whether Australia supported Timorese independence in any kind of legitimate way. But turning now to the hot topic of China, Professor Fernandez, and there are many aspects of the current state of affairs we could discuss, but let's focus for a moment on the question of the Solomon Islands, which has been in the news a lot recently. What's so striking to me about the extensive media coverage is that almost unmentioned, perhaps even unmentionable in polite company, is the fact there's a long, long history of Australia treating the Pacific nation and indeed nations surrounding it as a neo-colonial plaything, as an economic resource to be plundered and manipulated at will. Yet all the talk in the media has been about China's aggression in pursuing a security treaty with Honiara. So it's a very one-sided picture that the media paints. What accounts for this historical blind spot in the media and indeed among academics as well? Because to my mind, this is not journalism. It's jingoistic cheerleading.
Okay. These countries were, in fact, colonies. You know, before they became neo-colonies after independence, they were actually colonies. So if you look at where Nauru is, you might look at an island called Nauru, but actually parts of Nauru are spread out over New South Wales, Queensland, and Victoria as fertilizer. You know, it's been total exploitation of those places. Now, as for the Solomon Islands, what's important is to have strategic empathy. We know how we feel at the prospect of China having any kind of military ties with the Solomon Islands. And the Solomon Islands have said, no, it's just for development, right? Well, we know how we feel at the prospect of a military alliance between China and the Solomon Islands. Now, strategic empathy means we should understand how China feels about being encircled by a collection of sentinel states, garrison states, designed to uphold American pressure against China. We should have strategic empathy, just as we understand what it feels like if we are under threat. We know what we'd feel like if a Chinese base was set up in Indonesia or Timor. We should understand that China itself has its own security concerns. Instead, what we see is strategic narcissism. We tell other countries, look, our intentions are good, so don't plan for our capabilities because we've got good intentions. But then we say, no, 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 we don't trust your intentions. We have to plan for your capabilities. What's important is to reverse that dynamic.
Finally, Professor Fernandez, I'm sure you agree we live in extraordinarily dangerous times. The Russian invasion of Ukraine has led to the largest, most devastating interstate war on European soil since the Second World War. And the competition between the United States and its allies on the one hand and China and its still emerging allies on the other grows more intense by the day, it would seem. Very big question to end on, Professor, but how does Australia, and really here in this context I'm talking about the Australian people, not the government necessarily, how do the Australian people begin forging a path of genuine independence in the world, free from the looking to America, those pangs of kinship and so on, a genuinely independent path? How can we build a future for ourselves based on the principles of peace, justice and respect for the sovereignty of other nations?
We should begin by respecting the sovereignty of our own nation, never mind the sovereignty of other nations. Our own nation should be sovereign. Our own parliament should have the final decision on whether we send troops into combat. Our own parliament should have oversight of our intelligence agencies. Our own parliament and senators on the Joint Standing Committee on Foreign Affairs, Defense and Trade should have access to the confidential information at Pine Gap. Currently, the United States senators have greater access to the intelligence facilities on Australian soil than we do. So forget about the sovereignty of other countries. What about our own sovereignty? And then we can make our own independent decisions.
That was Professor of International and Political Studies Clinton Fernandez at the University of New South Wales in Canberra, part of the Australian Defence Force Academy. And as I said in the intro, also a former intelligence officer on the Indonesia desk for the Australian Army. So I'm sure you'd agree, a very interesting character, Clinton Fernandez, hardly fits the stereotype of the lefty ratbag on the street corner handing out pamphlets. This is very much an esteemed mainstream academic, still working for the Australian Defence Force Academy, making some as I say, very bold, forthright claims about the true nature of Australian foreign and military policy in the world. And I suspect that interview was quite confronting for some of you. We've all grown up with the lies and the propaganda about the Anzac myth and the myth that we're a nation that defends and values democracy and human rights and justice. And really, I would suggest even the most cursory examination of the historical record proves the opposite is true, that we are subordinate to and eager participants is a phrase that Professor Fernandez uses in his book, eager participants in a US-led imperial order, and have been so certainly since the Second World War. And Australia's imperial history, in fact, goes further back with the colonisation of Papua New Guinea, the imperial relationship with, as I mentioned in the interview, the South Pacific nations, and certainly continual military support for just about any American military adventure overseas one can think of, as I delineated or as I outlined in the interview, from the Korean War all the way up to standing in lockstep with American foreign policy in Ukraine. Australia is always there. And, of course, the delusion is that we are, and I shouldn't say we because I don't include myself in this, the we being the Australian nation, the Australian ruling class, which I don't identify with, that we, quote-unquote, somehow an equal partner of the United States. And, of course, that is a fantasy. We are a subordinate partner. But, and I think this is an important point raised in Professor Fernandez's book, we are, as he says, eager participants because Australia gains economically from its access to markets via its protection by the great power of the United States. It provides a certain degree of security of that trade, you know, through the Malacca Straits, through the South Pacific, etc. All these important trading routes are secured fundamentally by the American Navy. And that's true in terms ultimately of access to oil markets in the Middle East, which are secured by the American Fifth Fleet, etc., etc. The whole architecture of international economic affairs is governed first and foremost by one force and one force alone, and that is the United States Armed Forces, the Army, Navy, Air Force, and Marine Corps. And Australia's ruling class, the more savvy businessmen who constitute that ruling class, understand the nature of that relationship with the United States and the continuing importance of that relationship with the United States, particularly now, given the rise of the challenger nation of China, second largest economy in the world, and unquestionably, and some of you may disagree with this, but in my mind, unquestionably on the path to becoming an imperial power in its own right with global reach through its Belt and Road $1 trillion initiative, building economic infrastructure to connect the Chinese economy with trading routes throughout the world, through its diplomatic policies in Africa and Asia and Latin America. China's reach is growing all the time. And Australia is now at the crossroads as to which choice it makes. Is it going to forge an independent foreign policy, as we said in the interview with Professor Fernandez, an independent foreign policy based on principles of justice and fairness and respect for the sovereignty of other nations, or will it continue to run hell-bent, or run hell for leather, rather, into potentially the abyss of a Third World War? And I'm not being alarmist in using that phrase, potentially the abyss of a Third World War, by following the United States to hell in a handbasket, potentially even with war with China. These are enormous questions to deal with, and we thought it important to touch on some of them in that discussion with Professor Fernandez.
You're listening to the Indie Media Podcast, first broadcast on RTRFM 92.1.